Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We will, of course, do the numbers later on, but the number that really matters today goes like this. 60 to 38. That's the vote that got financial reform by the Senate. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here with us on this Thursday. It is the 15th of July, everybody. It's the 60 part of that vote that was important. It's the one that got the Senate past the threat of a filibuster. The House having already agreed, the bill is now on its way to the White House. But for all the wailing and gnashing of teeth over what went into it, a lot of the details and a lot of the tough decisions are yet to come. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
The epic fight to overhaul the financial system took more than a year, and it's not over. Congress is making federal regulators do the heavy lifting. Michael Greenberger is a former financial regulator who now teaches law at the University of Maryland. He says it's one thing to do battle in Congress.
It's another thing to then turn to the battle in the subterranean processes of administrative agencies where you're dealing with rulemaking, studies, reports.
In fact, the financial overhaul calls for 243 separate rulemakings alone. According to the law firm Davis Polk, Congress left some of the toughest decisions to federal agencies. Consider the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The legislation gives the new bureau the power to make rules and sue to enforce them, but it's not clear when that power can be used. Reed Kramer is a policy analyst at the New America Foundation.
So the bill creates these new tools, but we need to know that we're beginning a major construction project here, and it's going to have to be they're going to have to be used effectively.
And then there's the Financial Stability Oversight Council. Congress gave it the power to decide when a tottering financial institution is too big to fail. But the financial reform bill doesn't spell out when a too-big-to-fail bank should be shut down. Why give so much power to regulators? Ed Mirzwinski of the U.S. Public Interest Research Group says it's simple.
Is that regulators have expertise that Congress does not. The Congress is just not good at little details.
But Mirzwinski says Congress will have to keep a tight rein on the regulators to be sure they're implementing the legislation as lawmakers intended. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
There are those who would say the big banks have ended up with the reform bill that they wanted. They've been able to get bigger, for one thing, and more profitable, as J.P. Morgan showed today. It did report some strong numbers this morning, but it seems to have indulged in some, shall we say, creative accounting to get there. Completely legal, but creative nonetheless. All to make the bottom line look better for investors without really changing some of its underlying problems. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
J.P. Morgan Chase announced a big $4.8 billion profit this morning, and some news reports obligingly declared the company blew away expectations. Then analysts started reading between the lines, and at Rockdale Securities, Dick Beauvais saw the performance as stunning all right, stunningly disappointing for the country's second biggest bank.
It saw a decline in its deposits, it saw a decline in its loans, it saw a decline in the fees that it created, it saw a decline in its margins, and it saw a decline in its revenues. It was a terrible quarter.
So how could that yield more than $4 billion in profit? Beauvais says Chase pumped up its bottom line with an accounting strategy just about all banks turn to in tough times.
They reduced their reserves, and they took money out of the reserves and put it into profit. Most, if you will, hardcore analysts who look at a company won't accept that as being a valid way to increase earnings.
Beauvais did not use the phrase smoke and mirrors to describe this approach, but the Securities and Exchange Commission has come close since the economy collapsed. It's already investigating sleight-of-hand accounting for leaving hundreds of banks in a precarious state. But if you're thinking Congress must have addressed this bookkeeping hocus-pocus in its new financial fix, securities law professor John Coffey at Columbia University says, guess again.
There's very little in this financial reform bill that changes the accounting or disclosures. And there they have regularly engaged in this short-term gaming of the financial statements by correcting things on the last day of the quarter, and that simply blinds investors to the truth.
It shows how investors can't really rely on regulators to keep them safe, so says Charles Elson, who heads the University of Delaware's Center for Corporate Governance.
While the goal of the regulator is to box in the regulated, the goal of the regulated is to work around the regulator. So no matter what regulations come out, the game always continues.
And with a new round of rules, it's game on. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Not that you necessarily needed or wanted more evidence that the housing problem just won't go away, but it won't, not even a little bit. Home foreclosures, already at an all-time high, keep on climbing. The real estate data firm RealtyTrack said today that banks will likely repossess more than 1 million homes by year's end. That's up 38% from a year ago. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to try to figure out when it might end.
Keep in mind, foreclosures continue to increase, even though all those bad, toxic, really dumb mortgages people took out during the housing boom are mostly behind us. The problem now, says Susan Wachter at the Wharton School, is all the people who can't pay their mortgages because they're unemployed, or don't want to pay because they owe more than their house is worth.
We have a long way to go in many of these markets before home values rise to equal the level of the mortgages these households are paying on, or in this case, actually not paying on.
Wachter says low home values will lead to even more foreclosures. The foreclosed homes get priced cheap by the banks just to move them off their books. It's a vicious cycle, says housing analyst Desmond Lockman at the American Enterprise Institute.
We could expect housing prices to decline by perhaps another 5 to 10% over the next year before eventually stabilizing.
There is one bit of encouraging news, though. Banks are actually sending out fewer foreclosure notices. This is the first step when a homeowner gets behind on their mortgage, long before the house is actually seized. I asked Wharton's Susan Wachter, what's going on?
Lenders are increasingly looking to other options, loan modification, short sales, as lenders have more experience with them, and indeed as homeowners are coming to terms with the fact that they really have few choices.
And Wachter says between all the foreclosures and short sales now on the market, plus ridiculously low interest rates, it really is cheap to buy a house again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a sharp drop, then some stumbling along the muddy bottom, and then a recovery. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. China's economy had a rough quarter. Beijing announced today GDP slowed 1.6 percentage points. Of course, that kind of drop is a lot easier to take when you're starting with an economic growth rate of 11.9%. Now it hovers just above 10. Also today, and in a related vein, the Chinese government yanked some key subsidies for hundreds of exported products, everything from steel to cornstarch and fertilizers. What do all those have in common? Pollution. They make up the most energy-intensive parts of the Chinese economy. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports.
Consider them China's bad boys, dirty, energy-wasting industries that help keep China dependent on foreign oil and gas. Their pollution has left a trail of damaged lungs across this country. Economist Andy Rothman says by removing a tax rebate for them, Beijing is sending a couple of signals. One, we need to stop paying polluters. And two, our economy is strong enough to do just that.
The Chinese government is saying our economy is back to normal. It's back to the pre-crisis level, and we can resume the policy adjustments that we were making back in 05, 06, 07, and in the first part of 08 before the global crisis hit.
With GDP growth hovering around 11%, China's economy seems like it's back to its normal, phenomenal growth. And that's good, because some of these polluting companies will soon need all the help they can get. This is where it's going to hurt. 3 million tons of steel leave the port of Shanghai each month, making China the world's largest steel exporter. Not for long.
The door to export is closed.
Steel exporters here thought it was bad enough when the government allowed its currency to appreciate. Hong Kong-based industry analyst Helen Lau says removing this subsidy will slash China's steel exports in half.
Either they have to cut their production or they sell at lower prices, and either way, they make less money.
The winners in all of this, Lau says, will be Japanese and Korean steelmakers. And if all goes as planned, China's environment. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Monday was 6 months since the earthquake in Haiti, and despite billions of dollars in aid that were promised, a report from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee not too long ago summed up reconstruction in just one word: stalled. Companies that hope to get some of the major contracts that reconstruction would have brought have their own word: waiting. From WLRN in Miami, Kenny Malone reports.
By one estimate, there's enough rubble in the streets of Haiti to fill 5 superdomes. It's a sort of fitting statistic for developer J.R. Bergeron, who caused the earthquake.
The Super Bowl of disasters.
But Bergeron is stuck playing in the Pee Wee Leagues. He really wants to be in Port-au-Prince, to be on contract building new roads, paving new runways, and recycling debris. But a shortage of cash in Haiti means Bergeron is just waiting and working on projects in South Florida.
And not just am I waiting, the Haitian people are waiting. I mean, I can wait forever. Obviously, we're standing here right next to 595 right now, I-595, which I have a $100 million contract here. I'm not starving. They are.
Things seemed so promising. Back in March, 150 nations pledged more than $5 billion to rebuild Haiti. Contractors lined up. Bergeron quickly partnered with a cement importer from Haiti to make his pitch. Another developer went ahead and just shipped his debris removal equipment to Haiti, hoping for the best. Others actually started working, assuming a contract would follow. But very little has happened.
I don't think any money's really coming out into Haiti for another 6 months. It's a shame to say that, and it's a shame to see the people and the devastation that they're in.
Only 10% of the pledged money has actually come to the Haitian government. Prime Minister Jean-Max Bellerive says that without money, there can be no major contracts. And his own staff needs rebuilding, too. He says he lost some of Haiti's top minds during the earthquake, which happened right around 5 p.m.
Because who is working in the administration after 5 is the people working harder. Those are the ones that were crushed under the ministries.
Prime Minister Bellerive says his government has been able to issue a few small contracts to build 2 bridges in northern Haiti. But some companies have decided not to wait around for that big government contract to come through. The Innovita company has been piecing together enough small private contracts to be a rare success. Innovita sells prefabricated houses that are fireproof, waterproof, and earthquake resistant.
It's all this one material, Innovita plus glue. That's all. Now let me show you this.
A special model for Haiti was designed by one of Miami's most famous architects, Andres Duany. Innovita enlisted Duany to study Haitian culture, talk to anthropologists, and design the perfect shelter. What he didn't see coming were problems with land rights.
So you might build a house on a lot that maybe looks empty or has been empty to give to somebody, and then somebody might show up and say, sorry, that's my lot. You know, so it's very hard to establish ownership, and that's holding things up tremendously.
Back at his highway project, J.R. Bergeron is turning his impatience into something productive, a special project. He says until he can train Haitian workers in Haiti, he'll do it right here on I-595. Bergeron helped Henry Joseph and James Delva get temporary protected status, which will allow them to live and work in the U.S. for at least another year.
When they learn how to run the equipment, once they get off the shovels and starting just like I started, you know what I mean, right from the ground up, you learn your way how to do it, and then you can take that experience on for life and do it anywhere.
Joseph looks on as the excavator scoops up chunks of concrete.
What kind of a machine is it?
I don't really know, because I'm very new to the job.
You'll learn soon.
Yeah, I know I will.
You'll be driving one of these soon.
Yeah, I will.
At the current pace of reconstruction, Bergeron suspects Joseph will have plenty of time to learn that excavator. He says it could be a while before Joseph or anyone is hauling debris in Haiti on a large scale. From Miami, I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
Coming up, how do you define conservation?
Conservation is conservative. The two words come from the same root, and the ethic of true conservatism is to conserve, to save, to be prudent, to be a good steward.
All right, there you have it. But first, let's do the numbers.
Alas, J.P. Morgan's earnings failed to pull Wall Street out of a rut today. The Dow Industrials lost just under a tenth of 1%, 7 points, closed at 10,359. The Nasdaq ended almost flat, down about three quarters of a point, 22.49 at the bell. The S&P 500 dribbled down a tenth of 1%, 1 point, 1,096, the number you're looking for there. Disappointing manufacturing numbers were a big part of why the markets fell today, and companies in that sector had a mixed session. Honeywell ticked up 0.25%, GE notched up a third, Boeing ditched more than 0.5%, Caterpillar tracked down more than 0.25%. Investors chased J.P. Morgan half-heartedly after its earnings announcement, and the bank stock inched up 0.25%, Wells Fargo put on 0.5%, and Goldman Sachs raised up more than 4%. We'll tell you why later. Bank of America rang down 1.75%, Citigroup dropped more than 1% today. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.9%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at vanguard.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index. It tells us what urban consumers paid for goods and services in June. President Obama is scheduled for some vacation time. He heads to Maine. And 65 years ago, on July 16th, the nuclear age began with the Trinity test. The first atomic bomb was detonated in the New Mexico desert. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. When you think about Old Spice, you probably think about fuddy-duddy old guys wearing aftershave. Apologies right here if I've offended anybody. But Old Spice's newest ad campaign is a crazy hit with all kinds of people. Here's a little bit of it.
Hello, ladies. How are you? Fantastic. Does your man look like me? No. Can he smell like me? Yes. Should he use Old Spice body wash? I don't know. Do you like the smell of adventure?
That's actor Isaiah Mustafa as the very manly Old Spice man. Those ads are as outrageously over the top as they sound. They have gone completely viral online. And now the ad agency behind them has given viral practically a whole new meaning. They spent the last 2 days producing rapid-fire video responses to comments that people have left on Facebook and YouTube and Twitter. Equally over the top, I should say.
Jill Jukes Bagley tweets, Old Spice man. What do you do to let yourself unwind and let your hair down, etc.? Well, Jill, like any other man, I find candlelit dinners on top of dangerous ice crystals incredibly relaxing.
Yeah, me too. Ian Tate is with Wyden and Kennedy, the ad agency now in the limelight for those ads. Ian, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
This does sort of seem like advertising 2.0, doing this YouTube campaign in response to responses to the ad. How'd you come up with it?
We knew that there was a massive love for this guy and, you know, and a desire to be closer to him from men and women. So what happened was when we were tasked with doing something around the latest ad campaign to support that in the digital space, we just came up with the idea of, you know, what people would really like more than anything else is to actually, you know, kind of be in the shower with Isaiah. So that was kind of really where it started from.
Do me a favor and tell me the process that went into this thing. I mean, did you guys set out specifically to do Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and all these social media platforms that this thing has exploded across?
Absolutely. I mean, there was a team of digital people. They'd really planned out how this thing was going to roll out across, online. And lots of people will have seen the very high-profile celebrities that we responded to, but there was also people who have very specific kind of niche followings online who he addressed. So all of that was a kind of well-orchestrated campaign to really designed to spread into the far and distant corners of the internet. And, you know, and we wanted to use all of the platforms in the most interesting ways that we could. So YouTube is obviously the kind of the channel where people are sharing videos. Twitter is really the platform where, you know, where you can create an interesting sort of real-time social explosion like this. And, of course, we were doing things like Facebook and blogs as well. But we only had 48 hours to pull this off, so we knew we had to, you know, take a running jump at it and really kind of work every angle that we possibly could to make this thing take off.
My favorite one was the question from George Stephanopoulos. Of course, George had Isaiah on the program this morning, but he asked a political question about the president. And we're going to play a little bit of Isaiah's response here, in character, of course.
President Obama should henceforth only be seen in a towel. Also, instead of opening the State of the Union address with "my fellow Americans," try opening with "hello, ladies."
Yeah, I was going to say that's pretty good. You can't make it up, but actually it is made up, but it is pretty good.
Thank you. I mean, I, you know, like I say, this is a genuine kind of collaboration, I think, between the writers and Isaiah himself. And, you know, the guys have such an amazing relationship with it. They were able to write these things for him and pretty much nail it in a single take. I mean, I've never seen anything like it in terms of the ability to create things at that speed. And I think that's, you know, testament to the fact that you know, a great character and a great ambassador for Old Spice has been created that can do those things and can be quite kind of tongue-in-cheek about his relationship and use of the product in a way that feels very kind of fun and lighthearted. And we're waiting to see, you know, what effect this has on sales, but I think it certainly makes people kind of reconsider Old Spice in a new light again, and that's certainly borne out by all the conversations that we've been seeing online.
Ian Tate is Global Interactive Executive Creative Director for Wyden and Kennedy up in Portland, Oregon. Ian, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All right, we'll let the Old Spice guy take us out.
Well, friends, like all great things, this too must end. I'll never forget this time we spent together. I love you, always.
There are academic studies on pretty much every topic you can imagine released all the time. Most fade into the relative obscurity of one journal or another, but there is occasionally research that catches on with the mainstream media. One such example came out of UCLA a couple of months ago about a program aimed at inspiring people to save energy. "Nudges Gone Wrong" was a typical headline about it. Researchers apparently had found that some conservatives, as in political conservatives, didn't respond all that well to a little nudging from their power company to conserve. And that got our sustainability reporter Sarah Gardner thinking.
Thinking specifically about the politics of conservation. But first, that UCLA study. Economists analyzed a group of utility customers who were getting regular notices from their power company comparing their energy use with similar households. See, behavioral psychologists have convinced utilities that if customers can compare their kilowatt hours to their neighbors, they'll want to keep up with the Joneses. Turns out, that's not always true.
I'm absolutely unsurprised by this result.
That's Patrick Michaels, a senior fellow at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He shrugged at the study's results that show nudging ended up reducing energy consumption by a little, 1-2%. But here's the real headline. Some Republican households responded by using more power.
If you tell a class of grade schoolers, no talking right now, I guarantee you somebody's going to talk. This is not quite as command and control as that, but it is a little bit paternalistic on the part of the energy companies.
Paternalistic, big brother, intrusive. Jim DePesso is director of Republicans for Environmental Protection. He says it's understandable that some in his party could view utility nudges in that light. He says the Republicans who cranked up the air conditioning even more, post-nudge, may have been making a statement, but that doesn't mean they're not interested in saving energy.
Conservation is conservative. The two words come from the same root, and the ethic of true conservatism is to conserve, to save, to be prudent, to be a good steward. And how we got onto this idea that somehow conservation is not conservative is just mind-boggling.
DePesso says energy conservation started getting a bad rap in this country back in the 1970s.
I think the word conservation, energy conservation, for some people may bring to mind an image of, you know, a scowling Jimmy Carter sitting in the White House with a sweater and telling us all to shiver and turn the lights off.
Well, President Carter didn't say to shiver exactly.
And I'm asking you to take no unnecessary trips
to use carpools or public transportation whenever you can, and to set your thermostats to save fuel.
DePasso says the idea of energy cutbacks doesn't easily fit in with America's culture of freedom and enterprise.
But what we can do is we can have all these benefits, we can have all this abundance and prosperity, but we don't have to do it with so much waste. We don't have to do it with so much depletion of our natural capital. And I think that's a point of common ground that Republicans and Democrats can come together on.
In other words, an energy-saving light bulb is neither liberal nor conservative. It's just a smart investment. But environmental historian Paul Sabin at Yale University says political attitudes are also shaped by how you define the problem. Liberals like Jimmy Carter perceived an energy shortage. Conservatives like his successor, Ronald Reagan, saw untapped markets.
And if you don't believe there's a fundamental scarcity of energy, then energy conservation by itself can be seen as more of a personal decision, a values decision, as opposed to a social imperative.
Q Vice President Dick Cheney in 2001, when he said energy conservation might be a sign of personal virtue, but no basis for a sound energy policy. Still, energy conservation and efficiency are widely regarded as the low-hanging fruit for cutting fossil fuel consumption. Jim DePasso says utilities that want to nudge more conservative customers into conserving should forget those neighbor-to-neighbor comparisons and talk bottom lines.
If you save energy, you'll have more money to spend on things that you really enjoy. Unless you really truly enjoy sending money to your friendly utility.
You can count on that message getting a bipartisan reaction. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note, kind of rolling together two stories we started with today, financial reform and the real estate industry. You remember a couple of months ago, Goldman Sachs was accused by the SEC of fraud, of selling mortgage-backed investments to clients while at the same time betting its own money that those investments would fail. Today, Goldman agreed to part with a bunch of its own money to settle things, $550 million total, $300 million in fines, the balance in restitution to those who bought the securities. People who buy Goldman itself, that is, its shareholders and investors, clearly see the deal as a huge win for the company. Shares shot up today in after-hours trading after that announcement came out. And that is where we are right now, by the way, after hours. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 7 points, just under a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ off less than a point. We'll call that flat. The S&P 500 nudged down 1 point, a tenth of 1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, cooking up new ways to sell food.
There are just so many costs involved. If you want to continue cooking and you want to continue connecting with customers, then you have to be creative.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.